Spoiler alert. So Colorado probably is in the process of building the world's biggest connected vehicle ecosystem. And ironically, we're starting on the I-70 Mountain Corridor. And so if you're familiar with connected vehicles, basically what that is this. Starting in about 2021, 2023, GM, Ford, Volkswagen, Toyota are all going to be rolling all their cars off the line that are connected.
I love collaborations, and we need more of it in this transportation revolution. And while it's easy to demonize private companies or slander public organizations, the devil is in the details.
Colorado, the Centennial State, has embarked on a bold ambition to futurify their infrastructure, from building out new express lanes to engaging in public-private partnerships. Colorado is forging ahead in ensuring a safe and hassle-free transportation experience for all their residents. Tune in to hear from one of the leading advocates of transportation mobility in Colorado, Miss Amy Ford.
Amy is tasked with managing the 23,000 miles of roads in Colorado to provide a better user experience for kids, for working professionals, and to all stakeholders of their infrastructure system. And to manage all of this, it does take money. And where does she get it? Stay tuned. I'm Dennis Wisco.
Alongside Kelly Cruz.
And this is Wisco Weekly, where we share the voices of automakers, automotive retailers, and transportation professionals who are driving and shaping the future of automotive.
You are now tuned in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Chicka brown, chicken brown. Listeners and y'all tubers, if you're watching, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wisco Weekly, where we get to share the voices of automakers, automotive retailers, and transportation professionals who are driving and shaping the future of automotive. Today's guest, I'm very lucky to have on the show, especially as she's coming to me virtually. There's a lot of great things going on in the state of Colorado, and things that have been moving in a direction where, on one hand, there was a little bit of dissent in emulating some of the policies in California, but they did it. And certainly they have actually moved beyond some of the things that we are doing here in California. And these are some of the things that we're going to be talking about on this episode today. So my guest today has the second best job in the United States as the Chief of Advanced Mobility for the Colorado Department of Transportation, aka CDOT. My guest is responsible for accelerating innovation and technologies that maximize the experience of people, goods, and information moving on Colorado's transportation system. She directs program strategy for the Division of Mobility Operations, which exists to improve the safety and efficiency of Colorado's transportation system, and she directs strategy for the Road X program, which seeks to partner with the private sector to deploy transformational transportation solutions, such as connected, autonomous, Hyperloop, and other technologies. And if that wasn't enough, she also guides CDOT's Workforce of the Future initiatives, the Office of Communications, and serves as the chair for the state of Colorado's Autonomous Mobility Task Force. As a previous small business owner, my guest has accumulated over 20 years of experience working in transportation, education, and city public affairs. She is a proud fighting buffalo, having obtained her master's degree in public administration from the University of Colorado. Men, women, and children, please welcome to the show the delightful, the effervescent, Miss Amy Ford. Hello, Amy.
Well, thank you, Dennis. And I will have to ask you eventually sort of what the best job title in the United States is, but we can get into that later.
Well, who would you think would have the best job?
Well, I'm thinking his initials may be a little DW, but you tell me later.
No, the initials would actually be EM.
Oh, okay then.
Do you know who that would be?
No, well, you know, I can guess. And he has a bit of a Twitter problem. Is that the guy we're talking about?
That is the one. I mean, by my accounts, you know, as the founder of SpaceX and Tesla, I think he has a certain credibility on the coolness of his job.
You know what? It's so dang cool. And it's funny that, you know, you read this long bio and it sounded very, you know, governmentese. And a lot of people ask what I do. And I say, you know, I just get to go do the cool stuff right now in transportation.
That's what I'm
saying.
And
the reality is transportation is super cool right now. There's a lot going on.
So cool. So cool. Well, Amy, first off, how can people follow you?
Well, they can follow CDOT, obviously, on Twitter. We're at Colorado DOT, as well as on Facebook and Instagram. And, you know, I personally am on LinkedIn and, you know, share a variety of different things on some of the cool stuff that's happening out there. Not just ours, because, gosh, there's some amazing things happening. And California is one of the ones I ping a lot. And so, yeah, you can follow me there, just Amy Ford in LinkedIn.
Okay, great. Well, Amy, there's going to be a variety of things we're going to get into today, and certainly listening to you from afar to hear what's going on in Colorado, I'm hoping that we in California can emulate some of the things that you were doing there. So first off, I thought we could maybe talk about I-70 and the project there, your express lane. So first off, maybe if you could provide some background information, what was the problem with I-70, and, you know, tell me a little bit about the area that it serves.
Absolutely. So I-70 is our very famous highway. It's our only east-west route pretty much through the state of Colorado. And I-70 is the corridor that takes you to the mountains. So if you want to go to skiing at Vail and at Breckenridge and at Beaver Creek and Copper Mountain and this extraordinary multi-billion-dollar industry that we have here in Colorado, the way you get there is on I-70. And what that means is that we have upwards of 50 to 70 million vehicle miles traveled on that corridor every year. Wow. And it's significant, and it's only growing. I mean, even last year, where we didn't have the greatest snow, but we had the highest visits we've ever had up in that corridor in our tourist areas. So when you look at a corridor like that, you have a lot of interesting challenges. So one, it's gorgeous, right? You've got these beautiful mountains and all of that. You have basically two lanes in each direction. And people are loath to expand in that particular corridor because you've got this incredible environmental landscape that you want to be able to preserve. And you have a tunnel that you have to travel through. You've also got extensive grades that the cars and the vehicles and the trucks have to go up. And on top of that, especially during the winter, you've got heavy weather, extreme weather. And so you put all of those together and you get for a really interesting mix on a corridor, one that frankly is really tough, especially when you have a state that's growing the way Colorado is.
And so the project was now what?
Yeah. So what we were able to do is we effectively built a new express lane. But when I say express lane, and Coloradans and Californians now alike know an express lane for us is a lane that we toll to manage. And so we use the pricing of the tolls as a way of guaranteeing that we have a lane that is somewhat reliable. In other words, that if I guarantee you that it'll take 40, you know, go 45 miles an hour, that's how I do it. You know, we use the prices as a way of guaranteeing that. Well, we didn't have quite enough room, nor did we have quite enough money to actually build this full express lane. So what we did is, working with the federal government and others, we took the shoulder that was there on the road, we paved it out just a very little bit, and we turn it on as an express lane during those peak hours. So in other words, the Saturdays and the Sundays that people are coming back from the mountains, because right now we only have an express lane in one direction, and it's eastbound. So as you're leaving the mountains, you're coming home from a day of skiing, you can now go on to that express lane. And the result of having that express lane open is that we're seeing upwards of 50% travel time improvement. And that's not for the people on the express lane. That's for the people who are actually traveling in the general purpose lanes beside it when it's open.
Now, is there a reason why was this a matter of funds to only build out the express lane on eastbound as opposed to westbound?
That's exactly right. So effectively, for us to sort of pave out this shoulder, install all of the equipment that we needed to do the tolling and the like, it was about $100 million project for about 13 miles worth of this corridor. And you think, that's crazy. That's a ton of money for just that little bit of space. And that's exactly it. For us to actually add one lane in each direction in that corridor from about Denver, well, not quite Denver, from the edge of the mountains all the way through what's called Eisenhower Tunnel, for us and up to Vail, that would be about a $4 billion project.
Holy.
Yeah.
Wait, I would have thought it had just been $200 million. How did it go?
No. Because for us in the mountains, to actually expand one full lane in each direction,
okay,
from Denver all the way up to Vail, plus get through the mountains. And that means tunneling. And tunneling is very pricey. So what we do is we do these short fixes and with the money that we do have. And in this particular instance, it takes us $100 million to make a shoulder usable during basically peak hours. So, you know, the biggest challenge that we get with this lane is it works. When we open it, it works. Is the questions that we get from the traveling public saying, why isn't it on all of the time? And the reason that it's not open all of the time is because it's not a real lane. It's a shoulder. It's narrow. It's not as wide as your standard purpose lane. So we have an agreement with the federal government to allow it to be open for 100 days a year.
Okay. I actually was thinking that the reason why it's not open year round is because it is a toll lane. There's still, again, a financial cost that if it is open now 7 days a week, that perhaps between maintenance and whatever else, then again, mm-hmm. that's a cost that you guys have to bear. So
yeah, and less so that really, and more because it's technically a shoulder and we got permission to open it up to regular traffic, if you will, toll traffic. Certain times of the year. And so that's what we do with it. I mean, we'd love to be able to have it be a full lane, but we're just not there, and we just aren't there with the money.
And so then what is the cost now to go from Vail back to Denver area?
Yeah, so it depends on the time of day. And right now, this express lane, unfortunately, doesn't go all the way from Vail into Denver. What it does is if you're coming back from Vail, if you've ever driven through
Tunnel.
Yeah, you come back through the tunnels and it's on the other side of the tunnel. And it depends on the time of day, but it's anywhere from $5 to $8, which might seem pretty cheap, especially by California standards, or let's say Virginia, where right now traveling on an express lane costs you upwards of $40 for that trip. Oh. So we seem like a bargain right now, but you know, that rate will fluctuate, frankly. And as traffic builds up and that kind of thing, that rate will continue to go up, and it's all because of that reliability. You know, I always call it, it's like the Goldilocks of pricing, right? You can't price it too low where everyone uses a lane and it chokes up and it's just like traveling in a general purpose lane. You lose that reliability. You can't price it too high because then no one will use it and you lose the value of the added capacity that you've got with that lane. So you have to sort of Goldilocks it on the pricing. And so that's something that we do and we monitor dynamically and adjust the pricing throughout
sense.
The day or even throughout the, you know, throughout the year.
And so if I were to go on this express line, I take it there is no, you know, human booth, right? Is it just cameras and a transponder?
Yep.
Is that what it is?
It's cameras, transponder, or license plate. And so no surprise, if you have a transponder, you get a lesser rate. It costs you less to travel in the lane, as we don't have to go through the extra steps of validating your license plate and then sending you a bill. But you can travel in it as a license plate. And as you can imagine, we have a lot of tourists who travel in the area. They've rented cars and that kind of thing. And the car rental companies carry with them those transponders so they can make it easier to pass those, you know, to handle the cost.
Is there such a, so if I am a tourist and traveling in that area and perhaps the rental car that I have, their license plate, whatever, I'm not registered to use it, but I end up using it. Is there a penalty at all for me, or do I just have to pay the toll, whatever that toll is?
Typically, you're just paying the toll, but honestly, I'd have to double check with the rental car companies, but typically you pay the toll and they probably assess you a fee for processing.
Yeah, I think rental car companies, I'm sure, will. I had a terrible story where I had friends visiting from the Czech Republic and they racked up some tolls on the 73, the toll roads out here.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was already, you know, whatever, I had to pay the tolls, which is I was fine with. And I got another bill from the rental car agency over $300. I'm like, what the hell is this? I know rental
car. I was just in London this summer, and as you know, they have congestion pricing in the city core, and the rental car company was super clear. They're like, do not take a left at this turn, because as soon as you do, you pop into the congestion stuff. That they don't want to be very careful about that. So yeah.
Okay. So with regards to the cars that then travel on these express lanes or express lane. Is there any such data that you are not only maintaining but observing in order to optimize the experience for, you know, next year, for a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan? You know, are you allowed to share what those data points are?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we are continuously monitoring the data, and the data that we're gathering is travel times and travel speeds in the actual express lane. How many people are using it? How many people are using it for free on those lanes that are eligible for HOV use? And we do have some that are eligible, some that are not. Interestingly enough, the mountains is not eligible for HOV for free. And the reason why is because pretty much everyone who travels in the mountains is HOV already.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, so we're monitoring that kind of data. We're monitoring actually data about the general purpose lanes too. What's their flow? What's their traffic? How's it looking? Because, you know, this is a system. We're not just there to advantage how the express lane works. We're also looking at how it can help alleviate congestion that we see in our general purpose lanes. And we use that data as we move forward. We're looking at how we use some of that data actually as triggers for then when we need to start moving into an planning process on how we continue to add new capacity or add new mobility services in that corridor. Other things that we use, because, you know, in Colorado, our express lanes aren't just for cars. They also include bus rapid transit. For instance, our US 36 corridor has bus rapid transit. And one of the data pieces that we look at constantly is ensuring that that bus rapid transit always has a travel time of 45 miles an hour, so that that way they can hit their stops and keep their schedule. So that's a partnership we have with our transit agencies. So those are the kinds of information that we use. And no surprise, Colorado, just like other states, come into the idea of paying a toll to use a lane somewhat like kicking and screaming, you know, but I've already paid to use that lane, or no, I pay my taxes. And, you know, I think it's been a really interesting conversation that we've had with the public over time of like, no, this is new capacity. What the pricing of the tolls really does, the money that we generate from that does never pay. It never pays for the construction of these lanes, but it does help us a little bit offset the operations and maintenance. But again, we use that pricing as a way of managing reliability. But it's a continued conversation that we have with the public, too. So monitoring that public sentiment and that public outreach, especially as we expand express lanes, is another big piece of what we do.
And, well, let's talk about some of the financial aspects of the I-70 then. So I guess how was it paid for?
Yeah, so we actually paid for it with loans, if you can believe it. So we had enough to cover about 50 some million of it. We took out loans to cover, I think, upwards of about another 25 plus million, and made up the difference in other ways. And so we use the revenue that we gather from those tolls to help us pay back the loans. So this is, in this case, it's just like someone who wants to buy a house. We took out a loan to buy the house. And so that's how we did that particular one.
Was there no public private partnership?
Not on this one, no. And you know, what we do is we go in and we carefully evaluate sort of every a construction project and every potential project that might have an express lane on it. So for instance, our US 36 corridor, we built an express lane in each direction. And as we went through the analysis, we knew we didn't have enough money to build all the way from Denver, Boulder, Colorado. Consequently, what we did is we went in and did an analysis, where we realized that a private venture could come in, bring their additional dollars in, and help us finish that project about 20 years in advance of what we could have done. And as it turned out, the way that we could do that, like what's their return on investment, is they obviously need to make money on that deal. We could turn over the revenue from the tolling on 36 as well as our I-25 corridor, which is the corridor that comes down into Denver, and that made for a good business deal for them. So in that particular instance, it was Colorado's very first public-private partnership.
That was another one
that was our very first, was US 36.
Okay,
yeah.
Go on to your next point, but I want to come back to that point, but go ahead.
Yeah, we have one more that's coming up that's in process now, and it's for our central I-70 corridor. So we're talking I-70 in the mountains. This is the I-70 right through the middle of the city. We did the whole analysis. We, too, are building an express lane in each direction in that particular corridor, along with redoing a bridge and lowering it down and a variety of different other work. And in that particular instance, the revenue was not nearly enough to motivate a public-private partnership. So instead, we're doing something called an availability payment, which basically means this. We have $1.2 billion to spend on this project. And our private partner said, that sounds good. We'll take it in payments over the course of 30 years. We will also put some money in to help finance and build this project. And they believe that they're partnered with this. They'll make money off of the guaranteed dollars that we will be giving them over the course of 30 years. So there are a lot of different ways to do public-private partnerships.
And I'm sorry, what was that called?
Availability payments.
Availability payments. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's how we're doing the Central 70 project. So a variety of different ways, you know, all the way from just like pure bank loans to P3s with toll revenue to something like a P3 with an availability payment.
Okay, so actually this is a good transition because I do want to start talking about P3s then.
Yeah.
So I'm very much a novice and elementary when it comes to P3 definitions and policies and rules and guidelines and all that good stuff. So first off, maybe just give me a general overview of what a P3 is, and then we can start applying it to some of the projects you guys are working on. So what's the general overview?
So a P3 stands for a public-private partnership. And some people go, well, don't you do that all the time? I mean, you hire a private person, a designer or a contractor, to build your projects all the time. And the answer is, yes, we do. The difference in this is what they're doing. So the traditional explanation of a P3 is that you are working with a private partner to design, build, operate, and maintain, and sometimes finance a project. And in doing that, there is a transaction, if you will, between the public and the private partner, such that the private partner believes that they can make money on this particular deal. The public partner is looking with a private partnership to do a couple things. Maybe it's expand the project to do something we couldn't do, like finish it, like on our US 36 corridor, or also help alleviate risk. So, you know, in return for our payment, if you will, they say they'll be willing to take on the risk of designing the project, to build it, to operate it, to maintain it over time. And so a public-private partnership is a very contractual relationship that lays out the terms of how you share risk, how you look at financing, and how you make a project happen.
Now, so one of the things, and I got to tell you, offhand, and the way you described it, and some of the things, how I've come to understand it, I personally am at face value, I'm such a big fan of this type of partnership and interaction between private and public sector. One of the stigmas attached to P3, though, is the idea of these quote unquote backroom deals, right? And so,
yeah.
I guess first off, when I, you know, you hear that initially, and you all of a sudden you do start to kind of irk a little bit, like, oh geez, yeah, okay, here we go. There's some private company who's funding the pockets of the public sector. But you know, as I had time to digest this quote unquote backroom deal in the context of P3, I mean, if a backroom deal is nothing more than a group of private employees and public employees meeting in a conference room to discuss the contract and the terms and conditions, then I don't see what the difference is if you just had a staff of public employees doing that same thing or a staff of private employees doing the same thing. Is that stigma of the backroom deal as simple as I just kind of laid it out?
Yeah, yes and no. And, you know, I think the stigma of P3s as they first really started out was that the public sector is not very sophisticated in doing the deal.
Hmm.
And so the private sector took advantage of the public sector in a good way. They're business people. They're going to make the best business deal for themselves. And so, you know, the notorious ones that get talked about, you know, or Chicago was one of the early ones where they were doing a parking garage, where they turned over the parking garage to the private sector for certain things. And, you know, it's probably been not the greatest deal in the world. Or public-private partnerships where, let's say you create this relationship with the private vendor and the private contractor, and they bankrupt themselves. And then the public sector is left holding the bags of some of the commitment that the private sector made that they never fulfilled, never took on. So that's some of the risk, I think, that you run when you get into this. I think what we've had over the last few years, and, you know, would love to have our folks who run our P3 programs come and sit and chat with you guys further about all of this, but how we have much more sophisticated deal making and contracting, how we transfer risk. So I'm going to use the example. I'm going to hold our public-private partner accountable for the fact that they are going to be replacing the roadway in the next 30 years, that they're going to be doing regular maintenance, that they have very specific performance standards that they have to meet. And if they don't, there are different penalties and that kind of thing that are part of the relationship that we hold each other accountable
mm-hmm,
for.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing, I think, also for people to understand in a public-private partnership is we as the state always own the asset. So in other words, I'm not giving away our road and mm-hmm. I'm not giving away our property, if you will, to the private sector. This is something that is always ours, and we are asking them to operate and maintain it in return for a deal and then for money. And that's a good deal for them, and it's a good deal for us, we believe, in how we transfer and share that risk. But devil is in the details, in the contract sides. And that's back to also transparency. So it's the last comment I want to make, because backroom deals is always an interesting thing. And I think there has been, historically, there was that perception. We have, over the last several years, done a full bore transparency process on how we do our public-private partnerships. So we at every stage actually have public meetings and interactions where we share things like our traffic and revenue study. And that's basically a study that tells me, hey, should we go into a P3 or not? And here are the reasons why or why not. And so we'll sit and we'll talk with the public about that, with elected officials and other stakeholders, so you can see our decision-making process. We'll then have next step meetings where we say, hey, here are the deals and here's the kind of public-private partnership we want to do. Of an availability payment, revenue sharing, blah, blah, blah. Here's how we think we'll structure it. Here's what we think the elements of the contract are. Now, to an extent, obviously contractual deals, you know, have a lot of stuff with privacy and their proprietary information as regards to our private partners. But every step of the way, we have a transparency and accountability process where we work with the public to let them know how we're negotiating these deals.
Well, that's, I think that sounds absolutely fair. And certainly when the initial reaction of a backroom deal probably comes about, it perhaps is rooted in some idea that, well, these should all be debated on the Colorado House floor. And it's like, well, look, this is the reason why it's a P3. Like, there's probably not going to, we won't advance this project any further to continue to debate and talk about it. You know, then we would not have do a P3. We would just do it through a regular, you know, type of public financing. So
exactly. I mean, and that really gets to the heart of why we looked at P3s. You know, we have had historically for years and years a massive funding shortfall here in transportation in Colorado. In fact, we're short about $1 billion a year short in transportation funding.
That's what
the reason for us with the B. Yeah. So $1 billion a year. So think in California, you guys just did a couple things. In LA, you just passed the Measure M, which raised your sales tax to pay for transportation. The state, the legislature also just changed something where they changed the gas tax, I believe, and increased that. Our gas tax in Colorado, which is our only source of funding, has not changed since 1991. And imagine where you were in 1991.
I know, right?
And think about what you paid for things in 1991. Now, so not only is our tax flat, in other words, it's not indexed with inflation. Now think about the cost of living and the increase there. So you can understand why we have a gap. And then you add onto that a state that has grown by 50% in the last 20 years and is going to grow by another 50% the next 20. So the reason I sort of set the stage is because we started looking at a variety of different options to sort of keep Colorado moving. And so innovative financing and things like public-private partnerships were a part of that deal. And like I said, we've been working and learning hard, and I think really created an excellent program for that. And the reason we do these, again, is because the private sector brings something to the table. They help us move a project forward that otherwise we wouldn't be able to. They make it extend longer. They provide, you know, good and better service, perhaps, on the quality of what we can do on that road, that we maybe aren't always able to do because of some of our funding challenges.
So we have the different sources that we're looking at here: gas tax, a portion of sales tax.
Not for us, but you guys.
Yeah, yes. Not for you guys. Well, I mean, I won't even ask you that and set you up on that one. Okay, so potentially a sales tax, at least here in California. Congestion pricing, P3. Are there any other methods to raise revenue for infrastructure projects?
Well, you know, those are a lot of them. Fees, obviously, are a big part of that. You guys have them there in California. We have them here in Colorado. You know, vehicle registration fees and the like. We actually, as the DOT, don't get a ton of our vehicle registration fees. Most of the dollars go elsewhere to Department of Motor Vehicles and other services and such. But so fees are a part of that. But actually, this is where Colorado and California are both alike. We're also both exploring something called road usage charge. And you guys have probably talked a little bit about that maybe in the past on your show. So this idea, and I always say this, the gas tax was a perfect use fee for the 20th century, right? You know, ostensibly, the amount of gas you used was sort of the amount of miles you traveled, and it made a lot of sense. Well, in today's world of electric vehicles and hybrids that get, you know, 80, 90 miles to the hour to the gallon, that's what I happen to drive. Guess how much gas tax I pay?
Yeah, zero, right?
Very little. So I'm not exactly paying my fair share for the wear and tear that I put in on our roads. Now, I obviously the benefit to the environment and all of that. But so when you start thinking about use fees for the 21st century, a lot of discussion is, hey, pay for what you use. So you can pay for what you use, maybe by mileage, like counting per miles of how you travel.
How do you?
That's not something we're doing yet in Colorado, but we've piloted it, as have you guys in California.
How are you executing on that system? Like, is this a matter of, you know, somebody has to log in to a website every month and report? Are people buying miles every year when they have to file for registration? They have to submit miles. How is that being executed?
There are a lot of ways you can do it. And actually, that's what we're looking at in our pilots. And that's what you guys were looking at in your pilot. Mm-hmm. And as you might know, Oregon is doing it now. So you can actually choose, if you live in Oregon, you can either choose to pay a road user charge or you can choose to pay the gas tax. And so you can count it a number of different ways. You can go all the way from the no-tech version, which is literally you look at your odometer and you send in information on your odometer every
can
month.
Can I at least take a picture of it and send a picture?
You can take a picture of it and send it in, yeah. So that's one way. And let's say we charge, you know, 1.2 cents a mile or a cent a mile, and then that fee is assessed that you go. You can, in California, I think you guys just tested the idea of pre-buying. Basically, like, you put a down payment on it. You're like, hey, mm-hmm. I'm going to travel $20 worth of mileage this month. And you, it just sort of deducts your mileage. Now, how do you count the mileage? There's also technology ways of counting the mileage. You can do non-GPS based mileage, where it simply is saying, hey, you've traveled, you know, 10 miles, you've traveled 15 miles. There's also GPS-based, and why would anyone choose GPS-based? So again, it's not really following you per se, but it is saying, hey, I am on a public road and I am going here, or, oh no, hey, I've crossed into this state. I can no longer count miles as I don't have a road usage charge. Mm. Or better yet, in Colorado, the next piece of what we're looking at is, hey, I'm driving on a private road. And for instance, if I'm a farmer and I'm driving on private roads in Colorado, I can actually get reimbursed for the gas tax that I spend driving on private roads. Mm. But it's awfully hard for them to count that and to follow it and submit it for reimbursement. These systems can do it sort of automatically. So there are a number of different ways you can look at road usage charge. And it's all stuff I think that people are starting to say, hey, maybe the gas tax is a dying tax. Maybe it's not a fair way of people paying for their fair share of their wear and tear on the road. And maybe we should be starting to look at something that could replace the gas tax.
So I have a off the wall idea here. I'm going to just like throw
it
at you.
All right, I'm ready to hear it. We'll implement it in Colorado.
Well, hey, make sure, hey, it's a P3, all right? Get me on the private side, all right? Okay, so the whole idea of these miles then, so I've spoken about this before, and I'm still trying to really think through, you know, the system all the way through. But right, miles becomes this commodity, almost a currency. Like, would there be almost like this market in the same way that, for instance, in Europe, they have like the, you know, they're able to trade out their emissions
trade
to other
countries?
Yeah, you have your cap and trade kind of thing.
Like, that's very interesting. You know, that's very interesting, especially when you start attaching these miles into potentially congestion pricing, like you guys are talking about there in LA, right? You know, in what you're saying is basically, hey, not only will we charge you for the miles that you travel in the corridor, but we're going to charge you for the time of day that you travel them. And that's really more the congestion pricing side of you know, if you're on the road at rush hour versus X, you're going to be paying, you know, 3 cents a mile versus 1 cent a mile.
Yeah.
And so, the cap and trade idea of all of that and sort of the exchange, that would be very interesting.
That would be, I mean,
I bet some clever person will figure out how a way to monetize
that. Well, as long as the idea was heard here first.
That could be really interesting.
Well, I mean, to me, it would make the most sense because, you know, the way that I see it is that if indeed miles does become a commodity, then you should be able to buy and sell it. So at that point,
other things that will potentially become a commodity on in a transportation system is electricity or Wi-Fi. And so, you know, it's an interesting thing because let's say now you're not only paying for how many miles that you travel on the corridor. Let's say you're driving on a road that I've started looking at a pilot project on, where instead of charging your electric car at home, instead the vehicle is actually dynamically charging as it goes over my infrastructure. So I always joke, I'm like, why recreate the 20th century model of how you used to fuel cars, which is to build gas stations everywhere, aka charging stations. Go where the cars are, they're on our infrastructure. So their technology now is that you can actually dynamically charge a car as it drives over the roadway. So how would I charge for that? So not only am I going to charge and look at your miles, but I can't quite give away the electricity, right? So I've got to figure out a methodology for that as well. So you have all of these interesting things when you start creating a utility. Transportation is a utility. And then how do you create that in a commodities market is I'll let you figure that one out.
Oh, thank you. You're so benevolent.
Let me know.
Okay? All right. You got that. Okay. Well, let's kind of change up a little bit now, Ben. And thank you for all the information with regards to P3 and how that relates to Colorado. But I guess let's talk about now more of your department, the chief of advanced mobility and the RoadX program and the mobility operations. So I guess first off, the division of mobility operations, what goes on over there?
Yep. What is that? You're like, what is this thing?
Yeah.
So, you know, your folks, you've seen it all the time. It's not exactly new, but when you see a variable message sign on a road, or you see our cameras on a road, or you see we have an operations center that's monitoring what's happening and crashes and deploying emergency service personnel, that is mobility operations. But in today's world, how you pull those together, how you use data and data-driven decision-making to sort of create efficiencies in how you operate our roadways, that's what mobility operations is all about. Essentially, how is it that you can get the best use out of the road that you've got? Because again, we're not going to build our way out of this congestion, right? So how do you maximize the use of the road? So take the I-70 Mountain Corridor, for instance. Perfect example of a road that can be really tough, especially when I have people driving up there with bad tires in the winter and they spin out and get into crashes. It's just bad news. So we, over the years, have put in a very, very robust operations plan on that corridor that looks at how we handle our plows, how quickly we respond to crashes, how we meter people when they come and on and off the road, how we hold people and shut down the road so we can clear a crash really quick and bring them back onto the road. And in doing that, I'll use the example from 2015 to today, we have actually improved the travel times in that corridor. It doesn't sound by a lot, but when you're driving from Denver to Vail, by 10 minutes, and you're like, okay. Now it's 10 minutes when we added 50 million vehicle miles traveled on that corridor in the same period of time. So we had 50 million more miles traveled in that corridor, and we improved people's travel times by 10 minutes. So the way you do that, and we didn't add, and this is on the side, this is on the side that we did not add the express lane on. Okay. That one improved by like 13 minutes. And so that is through management. So that's what mobility ops does.
Okay.
But the mobility ops of now is also starting to look at connected autonomous vehicles. How do we prepare for this future that is coming? How do we create smart work zones? How do we create data-driven environments that are even to that next level? And we all know it's coming. Connected and autonomous vehicles are coming, and they're coming very quickly.
And so, but specifically, you haven't implemented any such technologies at the moment to...
Oh, no, we have.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. So Colorado probably is in the process of building the world's biggest connected vehicle ecosystem. And ironically, it's in. We're starting on the I-70 Mountain Corridor. And so if you're familiar with connected vehicles, basically what that is this. Starting in about 2021, 2023, GM, Ford, Volkswagen, Toyota are all going to be rolling all their cars off the line that are connected. So what that means is those cars can share data back and forth with each other and share data 10 times a second. Yep, V2V, vehicle to vehicle. So in other words, the cars have a lot to say. My airbag deployed, and it will instantly take that information and send it back to every vehicle behind it saying, airbag deployed, slow down now, detour now, you know, go another way. And people say, oh, well, that sounds like Waze. So picture Waze, except on mega steroids, because it is very, very fast. And very, very accurate, because who's telling you this? The vehicle itself is telling you all this data. So in order for it to happen, you need to have a couple things. Vehicles need to talk, and our car manufacturers are going to do it. They're rolling off the line. You also want the infrastructure to be able to listen and talk back to the cars and the vehicles. And that's where we come in as a road operator. So what we're doing is we are in the process of building the infrastructure that listens. And that means a roadside unit on a corridor, one every mile, that can hear that airbag deployed. And what it does is it instantly sends that information into our brain and our data ecosystem. We see it, we instantly respond, send out emergency responders and others. Or let's say hypothetically, I've got 15 cars and all their tires are slipping in a certain area. I know that I've got an icy spot and I need to deploy a plow out there. So that's the kind of information that's happening. And then the third thing you need is a brain to process all of this, a data ecosystem. So we're in the process of building the world's first commercial scale brain. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of pilots happening right now on all this, but San Diego has some and several other cities in California. But we're building a commercial scale brain with Panasonic that has capacity of handling 3 million, 5 million beyond vehicles that connected. So we can hear and listen. So that's happening right now. That brain will be done by 2021. And in the meantime, we're outfitting our I-70 Mountain Corridor and we're starting to deploy cars and vehicles that are aftermarket and they're going to do this.
See,
this now, why do I care? Yeah.
Well, I was
why
just,
do I care?
Well, first Safety. Off, this is why you have the second best job in the like. This all sounds really cool. Like, I'm so intrigued by the things that are going on now with all this connectivity that you just shared. So
yeah, it's super cool. And the reason that I care so much is because what they say is when these vehicles are talking to each other and sharing that information with drivers, has the capacity of reducing crashes by 80%. So now think about that. We lost over 600 people in Colorado to car crashes last year, and one death is too many. If I can reduce crashes by 80%, why wouldn't we be going after this aggressively? So that's what we're doing. So on top of that, we're actually now going to be building, we just got a $20 million grant to do this, another 600 miles of connected vehicle ecosystems all throughout the state of Colorado. And you know, it's pretty neat. And now you ask the question, okay, well, it's connected, but you've got autonomous cars that are sitting right out there. So imagine now that connected vehicle data is sending it to a human driver who gets to respond. Now imagine that data feeding into an autonomous driving system. And right now, you know, autonomous cars see what they see with their LiDARs, their cameras, their maps. Now feed in the data from every single car around them. And you've taken that autonomous driving system and you've elevated it.
Yeah, certainly.
So that's one of the cool things that we're doing and that mobility operations division gets to work on.
Well, you know, analogy that you used that I thought was actually pretty apt, because I was going to ask you about a similar analogy, and that was you had said that imagine Waze on steroids as a way to redirect traffic. And my initial thought too was, you know, when I was driving to LA the other day and I'm like, well, I use Google Maps, mm-hmm. It automatically updates me on if there's an accident and proposes some reroutes. So in my head, I'm like, well, I don't understand why more cities aren't just using Google Maps, aside from the fact that Google could now really become a monopoly in its own right. But certainly, yeah. I guess the fact that now the data, when you are using vehicle-to-vehicle data, that is much more accurate and much faster. So right. As to then deploy the proper reroutes to the other vehicle. So
exactly. I mean, 10 times a second, that's how fast the data is going to be going. And, you know, when we have 3 million cars in Colorado, let's say in 10 years, we're talking about 2 billion data points an hour. We're talking about data on the scale that you just haven't seen before. But here's the other interest. It's going to be all open data. So anyone can see it and pull it and take it and use it. And so it's pretty cool stuff that we're getting to be able to do and
yeah,
build here.
That is pretty cool. So, well, okay, so that's the division of mobility operations.
Right.
That one of the many things that you oversee. Then you have Rodex. And so what is Rodex?
Well, so Rodex always looks at what's next, right? So it's sort of our business development arm, if you will, to work with technologists and others to say, all right, what's coming? And so for the first 3 years of Rodex, it was really about connected and autonomous vehicles. And so, you know, whether it's connected vehicle program or, you know, driving an auto truck 100 miles down a highway with a load of beer and my career in the back if something happens. But, you know, so you know, that was Rodex's beginning. Well, today, Rodex really is about mobility on demand. It's about sustainability and electrification. And it's about new forms of infrastructure. And so, you know, I was at this little conference called CES a couple weeks ago, you know. And
what does that mean? What CES?
Yeah,
what?
I don't know. I'm sure none of your listeners have ever heard of. And, you know, I was there talking about our connected vehicle program. And then I was also there talking about flying cars and vertical takeoff and landing, to be more specific. And, you know, what does that mean when I have a transportation system that goes 3D? And what's our role as an agency and how we support that from a charging, electric charging perspective, or where they land and if they're going from rooftop to rooftop, or what the facilitation is of that. So Rodex is always designed to look at what's next. So those are some of the spaces that we're playing in.
Cool. Right on. How did you get involved? I mean, so you had a small business where you were doing communications.
Right.
So how did you get into...
How the heck am I talking about flying cars, right?
Yeah, right? It's like, I don't understand the connection between all of a sudden you're devising media campaigns and all of a sudden now you're overseeing flying cars.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's funny. So I have a master's of public administration with a background in management, and I started working in transportation for a number of years and did so in the communication space. And, you know, over time, I also managed different programs like transportation demand management, which is, you know, mobility options, you know, pooling and van pooling and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But frankly, you know, over the last several years, programmatically, I saw what was happening in the technology space and frankly went to our executive director and said, listen, if we want to be a leading state and if we really want to make a difference when it comes to safety, we need to own something, and we need to own this space of advanced mobility and technology. And I say that California was doing a ton in area, you know, Michigan, and, you know, we're not a state that has car manufacturers or Silicon Valley, but we do have a lot going on in Colorado. And we agreed. And so that's what was the impetus to start the RoadX program and basically tell the private sector and the technologists and others, say, come work with us. We're programmatically going to work with you, and we'll have some dollars that we'll put into this. We're going to have the policies, the regulatory environments and like, and that's why I'm dealing with companies like Hyperloop and Virgin Hyperloop One. You know, we're sitting and working with them on the governance and the regulatory and the environmental process to actually build it. You know, technology is an amazing thing and they can build a lot of stuff. Hyperloop is going to figure out how to do their stuff, how they actually build it on you know, U.S. soil through the environmental process is a whole other thing that requires government involvement. So that's the kind of space that we play in. So that's what I've been able to do from a policy perspective to a regulatory to project management to budgeting. It's been a fun ride.
Well, speaking of a impending Hyperloop in Colorado, we here are still trying to fuss with the bullet train. Mm-hmm. My transportation correspondent here, Rudy Solo, he has a question for you from afar, if you would mind entertaining his question. So please listen in.
All right, take it away, Rudy.
Amy, hi, this is Rudy Solo. I'm a huge fan of the progressive approaches that the Colorado Department of Transportation is trying to take in your great state. I think we in California can take a few lessons. In fact, what I've been arguing for forever is the need for a designated lane for autonomous vehicles. So it's great that Colorado is leading the charge on that. One thing that I'm trying to argue here in the state of California is we should scrap our plans for the high-speed rail and create the world's first solely designated autonomous vehicle highway. How can you help me craft that argument for people in the state of California that are currently considering or reconsidering whether or not we should move forward with the high-speed rail?
First off, let it be known that I am brokering this P3 deal right now. Rudy Solo, by trade, is a public finance attorney, so he works for a private sector company. You obviously know CDOT. So, boom, this is my contribution to P3 right now.
I see it.
So, as Rudy was asking, how can you help him strategically kill the high-speed rail in an effort to bring about an autonomous vehicle lane in California?
My Caltrans and my California Transportation Authority partners would be real happy to hear me speculate on this. So anything I say, I absolve myself of right now, right now. You know, it's complicated, isn't it? And when you talk about investments in high-speed rail and things like Hyperloop, we're talking about billions of dollars, and we all know that. And, you know, the interesting part about dedicating a system for just autonomous vehicles is how much throughput you can actually get in that system. So here are the things that I would suggest if you are actually going to promote something like that. When you think about a throughput, and actually a company that was right there in LA, Arrivo, which unfortunately just closed its doors, had sort of an interesting hybrid between Hyperloop technologies on sleds that were in a lane that had the capacity of moving at up to 200 miles an hour, so it would take the vehicles through. So the risks and challenges that you run with sort of the speed and the travel. So I'll tell you the risks. Autonomous vehicle lane. you can start platooning the vehicles. You can start running them 6 inches off of each other's bumper and keep them running. Right now, a traditional lane can get 2,000 vehicles through an hour. That's with human drivers. So let's assume that you could double that. So 4,000 cars, let's say, through on an autonomous driving system that's platooned, and it creates utter efficiency in how the vehicles move. And then those vehicles are moving all of the time. So therein lies the trick. Is it single occupant in those cars, or is it multiple occupants in those cars? Because you're still in a state and still in an environment where you're having a lot of people and a lot of people who need to move. So the one value on the train side, if you will, or the is the mass part of transit, is the mass movement of people. And so, yes, could you move autonomous cars? And this is where I don't have the figure exactly, but let's say we could double the capacity of that roadway. So you could go from 2,000 an hour to 4,000 an hour. How many people are in those cars is still an important piece. So how could you incentivize that and create that? The other thing that you run, and the challenge that you run right now with autonomous only, is the fact that autonomous vehicles will be on the road all the time. And let's presume that, let's say you have a Lyft fleet of autonomous vehicles, okay? And I no longer own a car, because all I do is I dial up my Lyft and I'm going to get it to take me from point A to point B. And then it's going to turn around and take you from point A to point B, just like it does today. But it never stops. It's always going. My car, which I used to have, which used to sit in my garage for 90% of the day, now is on the road all the time. So the predictions are, with autonomy, of course, is that our vehicle miles travel, that the cars on the road, is simply going to go up. So how do you manage that? So you might be moving more efficiently through, but you're adding more cars in, potentially, especially if they're single occupant. And that lane can only handle so much. So it might be efficient, but then the question is, how fast can it go? Can I get it to go 70, 80 miles an hour? Can it go 50 miles an hour when I get my congestion, and how quickly can we go? So those are the things that I think you want to sit and start looking at. And what kind of lanes can you do? Can you start double-decking them to start create more efficiencies? Because, again, you're not having to worry about human drivers who are jumping off the sides of roads and that kind of thing. So I guess what I say when I say, how would you do it? I think you've got to plan out sort of the careful throughput of what those designated lanes look like, how you would do the autonomy, how you would have sort of the cohesiveness of the connectivity between the systems on the platooning side, and frankly, how you get more people into the vehicles so that you can get to the mass part of the transportation that you would lose when you lose something like the high-speed rail.
Well, we will answer those questions here in California, and when we have those answers, we will then send them back to you.
Let me know.
And let you know. We have one last question from him.
All right.
One final question. Do you think that if we ever get to the place where we have autonomous and connected vehicles out on our roads, do you think that can have an extremely negative impact on transit ridership? Do you think that it could replace what we have been building throughout this nation for the last several decades of transit systems? I'm just curious of your thoughts on that.
Well, I think, in general, we're already seeing the effects of ride sharing and what it's doing on transit ridership and people's instinct with the ease of technology to be able to order up a ride and be able to go from point to point is already having an impact on ridership, on transit ridership. And we've seen that in big cities like San Francisco. You're seeing it in Denver. You're seeing it in LA. What I always say with this, with autonomous vehicles and the like, will it replace the small, shorter local route trips and the like? Very possibly, because of the ability to go point to point, the ability to do it on a personal service mobility on demand when you need it. Will it substitute the true mass transit where you are, for instance, we have a light rail line here in Colorado that moves, you know, upwards of 40,000 people a day. There's no way, I think, that autonomous vehicles and connected can move that kind of volume. So my prediction for the future is this, that heavy investment in big mass transit, so light rail, commuter rail, heavy transit corridors. We have one in Colorado, Colfax Avenue, that has upwards of 6 million boards a year on that particular one. That I don't think goes away. I think the smaller local route trips start to transform. And, you know, you've had experiences like that Chariot, which just shut down. It was owned actually by Ford here, but was microtransit that was duplicating some of those kinds of services of autonomy and point to point and ride share. That may become more prevalent. So you'll see, I'm going to say this, smaller, more right-sized transit that does smaller type trips point to point. That might be the investment. And so these long buses that you've seen that have 5 and 6 people in them because they're going a certain prescribed route, that may change.
Well, Amy, good God.
We could talk for a long time.
Well,
couldn't we?
Yeah, and furthermore too, it's like we should take a break, have a drink, and then come back, and then we got round 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and we continue on. But nonetheless,
you know what? We'd love to do that. That would be awesome.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for dropping all your knowledge and sharing all the great things that are going on in Colorado, and we appreciate certainly the level of detail that you and the level of candidness, furthermore, that you've been able to express. And so I'm personally thankful for that. Again, listeners, I will have her information on the episode page so you can follow her there. Have I left out anything, Amy? Is there anything else that we should be touching upon?
Oh, my gosh. You know, what I'd love to hear eventually, and maybe your listeners have the opportunity to ask questions, is I'd like to know their thoughts on some of this. Because, you know, I talk about things like express lanes, and I'd love to hear if they like express lanes and how they use them. Or the idea of a road usage charge and what bothers them about, you know, would that be a great approach? Or autonomous vehicles, would they ever get into one? So, and then when we get a flying car, I'd love to hear more about that.
I'm with that too. And listeners, please do chime in. I want to hear everything. And again, the good, bad, and the ugly of all this, because certainly no one has the answer here, but we do need more input on how these systems work, as at the end of the day, they are designed for you. The more questions I ask, the more the future of automotive, transportation, and dealership get more complicated. But one thing is for sure, we need to engage one another proactively to shape our automotive and transportation future and to find a way to pay for it.
That was great to hear from Amy, and thank you so much to her for being on our show. Listeners, what do you think? Do public-private partnerships work? Can we find the balance between public safety and managing profit? Tell us your thoughts on our Facebook page or our website. Tune in next week for a brand new episode of Wisco Weekly. And how do we end every episode?
Cheers, prost, l'chaim, kipis, nastravi, salu, kampai, mabruk, tutsint, gambe, yamas. To the customer experience.